Europe and the Faith by Hilaire Belloc. Part 3 of the Introduction. From so recent and universal an example, I turn to one local, distant, precise, in which this same Catholic conscience of European history may be tested. Consider the particular and clerical example of Thomas à Becket, the story of St. Thomas of Canterbury. I defy any man to read the story of Thomas à Becket in Stubbs, or in Green, or in Bright, or in any other of our provincial Protestant handbooks, and to make head or tail of it. Here is a well-defined and limited subject of study. It concerns only a few years. A great deal is known about it, for there are many contemporary accounts. Its comprehension is of vast interest to history. The Catholic may well ask, how is it I cannot understand the story as told by these Protestant writers? Why does it not make sense? The story is briefly this. A certain prelate, the primate of England at the time, was asked to admit certain changes in the status of the clergy. The chief of these changes was that men attached to the church in any way, even by minor orders, not necessarily priests, should, if they committed a crime amenable to temporal jurisdiction, be brought before the ordinary courts of the country, instead of left, as they had been for centuries, to their own courts. The claim was at the time a novel one. The primate of England resisted that claim. In connection with his resistance, he was subjected to many indignities. Many things outrageous to custom were done against him. But the Pope doubted whether his resistance was justified, and he was finally reconciled with the civil authority. On returning to his see at Canterbury, he became at once the author of further action and the subject of further outrage, and within a short time he was murdered by his exasperated enemies. His death raised a vast public outcry. His monarch did penance for it. But all the points on which he had resisted were in practice waived by the church at last. The civil state's original claim was, in practice, recognized at last. Today it appears to be plain justice. The chief of St. Thomas's contentions, for instance, that men in orders should be exempt from the ordinary courts, seems as remote as chain armor. So far, so good. The opponent of the faith will say, and has said in 100 studies, that this resistance was nothing more than that always offered by an old organization to a new development. Of course it was. It is equally true to say of a man who objects to an aeroplane smashing in the top of his studio that it is the resistance of an old organization to a new development. But such a phrase in no way explains the business. And when the Catholic begins to examine the particular case of St. Thomas, he finds a great many things to wonder at and to think about, upon which his less European opponents are helpless and silent. I say helpless, because in their attitude they give up trying to explain. They record these things, but they are bewildered by them. They can explain St. Thomas's particular action simply enough. Too simply. He was, they say, a man living in the past. But when they are asked to explain the vast consequences which followed his martyrdom, they have to fall back upon the most inhuman and impossible hypotheses, that the masses were ignorant, that is, as compared with other periods in human history. What, more ignorant than today? That the papacy engineered an outburst of popular enthusiasm. As though the papacy were a secret society like modern Freemasonry, with some hidden machinery for engineering such things. As though the type of enthusiasm produced by the martyrdom was the wretched mechanical thing produced now by caucus or newspaper engineering. As though nothing besides such interferences was there to arouse the whole populace of Europe to such a pitch. As to the miracles which undoubtedly took place at St. Thomas's tomb, the historian who hates or ignores the faith had and has three ways of denying them. The first is to say nothing about them. It is the easiest way of telling a lie. The second is to say that they were the result of a vast conspiracy which the priests directed and the feeble acquiescence of the maimed, the halt, and the blind supported. The third, and for the moment most popular, is to give them modern journalistic names, sham Latin and Greek confused, which, it is hoped, will get rid of the miraculous character. Notably do such people talk of auto-suggestion. Now, the Catholic approaching this wonderful story, when he has read all the original documents, understands it easily enough from within. He sees that the stand made by St. Thomas was not very important in its special claims, and was probably, taken as an isolated action, unreasonable. But he soon gets to see, as he reads and he notes, the rapid and profound transformation of all civilization which was taking place in that generation, that St. Thomas was standing out for a principle, ill-clothed in his particular plea, but absolute in its general appreciation. The freedom of the Church. He stood out in particular for what had been the concrete symbols of the Church's liberty in the past. The direction of his actions was everything, whether his symbol was well or ill chosen. The particular customs might go, but to challenge the new claims of civil power at that moment was to save the Church. A movement was afoot which might have then everywhere accomplished what was only accomplished in parts of Europe 400 years later, to wit, a dissolution of the unity and the discipline of Christendom. St. Thomas had to fight on ground chosen by his enemy. He fought and he resisted in the spirit dictated by the Church. He fought for no dogmatic point. He fought for no point to which the Church of 500 years earlier or 500 years later would have attached importance. He fought for things which were merely temporal arrangements, which had indeed, until quite recently, been the guarantee of the Church's liberty, but which were in his time upon the turn of becoming negligible. But the spirit in which he fought was a determination that the Church should never be controlled by the civil power, and the spirit against which he fought was the spirit which, either openly or secretly, believes the Church to be an institution merely human, and therefore naturally subjected, as an inferior, to the processes of the monarchs, or worse, the politicians, law. A Catholic sees, as he reads the story, that St. Thomas was obviously and necessarily to lose, in the long run, every concrete point on which he had stood out. And yet he saved, throughout Europe, the ideal thing for which he was standing out. A Catholic perceives clearly why the enthusiasm of the populace rose. The guarantee of the plain man's healthy and moral existence against the threat of the wealthy and the power of the state. The self-government of the general Church had been defended by a champion up to the point of death, for the morals enforced by the Church are the guarantee of freedom. Further, the Catholic reader is not content, as is the non-Catholic, with a blind, irrational assertion that the miracles could not take place. He is not wholly possessed of a firm and lasting faith that no marvelous events ever take place. He reads the evidence. He cannot believe that there was a conspiracy of falsehood in the lack of all proof of such conspiracy. He is moved to a conviction that events so minutely recorded and so amply testified happened. Here again is the European, the chiefly reasonable man, the Catholic, pitted against the barbarian skeptic with his empty, unproved, mechanical dogmas of material sequence. And these miracles, for a Catholic reader, are but the extreme points fitting in with the whole scheme. He knows what European civilization was before the 12th century. He knows what it was to become after the 16th. He knows why and how the church would stand out against a certain itch for change. He appreciates why and how a character like that of St. Thomas would resist. He is in no way perplexed to find that the resistance failed on its technical side. He sees that it succeeded so thoroughly in its spirit as to prevent, in a moment when its occurrence would have been far more dangerous in general than in the 16th century, the overturning of the connection between church and state. The enthusiasm of the populace he particularly comprehends. He grasps the connection between that enthusiasm and the miracles which attended St. Thomas's intercession, not because the miracles were fantasies, but because a popular recognition of deserved sanctity is the later accompaniment and the recipient of miraculous power. It is the details of history which require the closest analysis. I have, therefore, chosen a significant detail with which to exemplify my case. Just as a man who thoroughly understands the character of the English squires and of their position in the English countrysides would have to explain at some length and with difficulty to a foreigner how and why the evils of the English large estates were, though evils, national. Just as a particular landlord case of peculiar complexity or violence might afford him a special test, so the martyrdom of St. Thomas makes for the Catholic who is viewing Europe a very good example whereby he can show how well he understands what is to other men not understandable, and how simple is to him, and how human, a process which, to men not Catholic, can only be explained by the most grotesque assumptions, as that universal contemporary testimony must be ignored, that men are ready to die for things in which they do not believe, that the philosophy of a society does not permeate that society, or that a popular enthusiasm, ubiquitous and unchallenged, is mechanically produced to the order of some center of government. All these absurdities are connoted in the non-Catholic view of the great quarrel, nor is there any but the Catholic conscience of Europe that explains it. The Catholic sees that the whole of the Becket business was like the struggle of a man who is fighting for his liberty, and is compelled to maintain it, such being the battleground chosen by his opponents, upon a privilege inherited from the past. The non-Catholic simply cannot understand it, and does not pretend to understand it. Now let us turn from this second example, highly definite and limited, to a third, quite different from either of the other two, and the widest of all. Let us turn to the general aspect of all European history. We can here make a list of the great lines on which the Catholic can appreciate what other men only puzzle at, and can determine and know those things upon which other men make no more than a guess. The Catholic faith spreads over the Roman world, not because the Jews were widely dispersed, but because the intellect of antiquity, and especially the Roman intellect, accepted it in its maturity. The material decline of the empire is not co-relative with, nor parallel to, the growth of the Catholic Church. It is the counterpart of that growth. You have been told, Christianity, a word, by the way, quite unhistorical, crept into Rome as she declined, and hastened that decline. That is bad history. Rather, accept this phrase and retain it. The faith is that which Rome accepted in her maturity, nor was the faith the cause of her decline, but rather the conservator of all that could be conserved. There was no strengthening of us by the advent of barbaric blood. There was a serious imperiling of civilization in its old age by some small, and mainly servile, infiltration of barbaric blood. If civilization so attacked did not permanently fail through old age, we owe that happy rescue to the Catholic faith. In the next period, the Dark Ages, the Catholic proceeds to see Europe saved against a universal attack of the Mohammedan, the Hun, the Scandinavian. He notes that the fierceness of the attack was such that anything save something divinely instituted would have broken down. The Mohammedan came within 3 days' march of Tours. The Mongol was seen from the walls of Tournus on the Saone, right in France. The Scandinavian savage poured into the mouths of all the rivers of Gaul, and almost overwhelmed the whole island of Britain. There was nothing left of Europe but a central core. Nevertheless, Europe survived. In the reflorescence which followed that dark time, in the Middle Ages, the Catholic notes not hypotheses but documents and facts. He sees the parliaments arising not from some imaginary Teutonic root, a figment of the academies, but from the very real and present great monastic orders, in Spain, in Britain, in Gaul, never outside the old limits of Christendom. He sees the Gothic architecture spring high, spontaneous and autochthonic, first in the territory of Paris, and thence spread outwards in a ring to the Scotch Highlands and the Rhine. He sees the new universities, a product of the soul of Europe, reawakened. He sees the marvelous new civilization of the Middle Ages rising as a transformation of the old Roman society, a transformation wholly from within and motived by the faith. The trouble, the religious terror, the madnesses of the 15th century, are to him the diseases of one body, Europe, in need of medicine. The medicine was too long delayed. There comes the disruption of the European body at the Reformation. It ought to be death, but since the Church is not subject to mortal law, it is not death. Of those populations which break away from religion and from civilization, none, he perceives, were of the ancient Roman stock, save Britain. The Catholic, reading his history, watches in that struggle England, not the effect of the struggle on the fringes of Europe, on Holland, North Germany, and the rest. He is anxious to see whether Britain will fail the mass of civilization in its ordeal. He notes the keenness of the fight in England and its long endurance. How all the forces of wealth, especially the old families such as the Howards and the merchants of the city of London, are enlisted upon the treasonable side. How in spite of this a tenacious tradition prevents any sudden transformation of the British polity or its sharp severance from the continuity of Europe. He sees the whole of North England rising, cities in the south standing siege. Ultimately, he sees the great nobles and merchants victorious, and the people cut off, apparently forever, from the life by which they had lived, the food upon which they had fed. Side by side with all this, he notes that, next to Britain, one land only that was never Roman land, by an accident inexplicable or miraculous, preserves the faith. And as Britain is lost, he sees, side by side with that loss, the preservation of Ireland. To the Catholic reader of history, though he has no Catholic history to read, there is no danger of the foolish bias against civilization which has haunted so many contemporary writers, and which has led them to frame fantastic origins for institutions the growth of which are as plain as a historical fact can be. He does not see in the pirate raids which desolated the eastern and southeastern coasts of England in the 6th century the origin of the English people. He perceives that the success of these small eastern settlements upon the eastern shores, and the spread of their language westward over the island, dated from their acceptance of Roman discipline, organization, and law, from which the majority, the Welsh to the west, were cut off. He sees that the ultimate hegemony of Winchester over England all grew from this early picking up of communications with the continent, and the cutting off of everything in this island save the south and east from the common life of Europe. He knows that Christian parliaments are not dimly and possibly barbaric, but certainly and plainly monastic in their origin. He is not surprised to learn that they arose first in the Pyrenean valleys during the struggle against the Mohammedans. He sees how probable or necessary was such an origin just when the chief effort of Europe was at work in the Reconquista. In general, the history of Europe and of England develops naturally before the Catholic reader. He is not tempted to that succession of theories, self-contradicting and often put forward for the sake of novelty, which has confused and warped modern reconstructions of the past. Above all, he does not commit the prime historical error of reading history backwards. He does not think of the past as a groping towards our own perfection of today. He has in his own nature the nature of its career. He feels the fall and the rise, the rhythm of a life which is his own. The Europeans are of his flesh. He can converse with the first century or the 15th. Shrines are not odd to him, nor oracles. And if he is the supplanter, he is also the heir of the gods. End of the Introduction to Europe and the Faith.